Geekily Yoked is a proud member of the Crossover Nexus. To find more blogs and podcasts about the intersection of faith and pop culture, check out crossovernexus.com. Tell them Bilbo sent you.
So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I am Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto with a PhD in medieval literature, and that makes me a giant nerd.
I am a Lovecraft impersonator and stay-at-home dad, and that qualifies me to call myself a huge dork. And welcome to our potpourri episode.
Yeah, you know how, like... Sorry, I'm clearing my throat because I haven't even prepared that much for this podcast.
Boop.
We are, you know, like we're always super well prepared with
well,
content
we're cogent.
That, yeah, like this isn't even that level
well,
of forethought.
We were inspired by the season of Pentecost to just see where the Spirit moves us.
Right.
Also, Rachel's got a sermon, and we're crazily running off to Montreal next week, so...
For the Canadian Clergy Under 40 Conference.
Woo!
I guess I should specify Anglican clergy.
Anglican clergy under 40.
Yes.
We're taking a train! With a baby!
This cannot end badly in any way!
Well, we learned that she can do okay for some period of time in a car.
Yeah.
But on a train... There will be lots of people.
And I still think you can stick her in the carrier and walk up and down the train and hopefully get her to sleep.
Because that
way.
Won't also disrupt people. Just random dude walking up and down with a baby.
I'm sure they've seen weirder things on those trains.
That's very true. So yes, we are woefully unprepared.
Yeah, we got nothing. This is just a delightful experiment in... complete and utter randomness.
Well, again, we're gonna see just where this journey takes us, Rachel. You don't need to have a map or a GPS to tell you where to go.
It's usually helpful to have a topic.
Jesus?
Okay.
What are your thoughts? You a fan?
Generally.
Well, there we go. So, topic covered. We just finished watching all of Orange is the New Black.
That's true. We did that.
Yeah, that was a trip. That had nuns. That's religious.
She got excommunicated.
Okay.
Sorry, that was a spoiler. I should not.
Well, it's Orange is the New Black. If people who care have already binged as much as we have.
That is true.
But that was something that sort of like irked me. Would they actually excommunicate her or would they just defrock her?
No, they wouldn't.
Because there were some other interesting religious choices, or at least liturgical choices, that they made.
Oh, the dude with the cassock alb and the preaching scarf?
Yes.
And the green liturgical antipendia in the church at a funeral?
Not okay?
No!
Why not, Rachel?
Because it's... You have two options.
Okay.
Either you follow the sort of Vatican II approach,
yes,
which generally the Anglican Church does too, where you have white at funerals because that is the white is the color for Easter and the resurrection and the promise of eternal life, or you have purple to like in sort of the more old school approach of penitence and death and
all that jazz.
Yes.
No green.
Not green.
My guess is that they just went to the church and you have like a 90% chance that it's going to be green.
Maybe not 90% chance.
There's a lot of green, Rachel.
I would say maybe 70.
I've seen your scarf. There is a lot of green.
I have a liturgical scarf that my friend made me. It follows the seasons of the church year. There's a lot of green.
There's a lot of green on that thing. But no, so this nun they said was excommunicated, but that's...
She wouldn't have been excommunicated.
Has anyone been excommunicated in a while?
Probably, but like...
Like, I think of that as like something reserved for kings.
I feel like saying the church was no longer going to cover her legal expenses,
yeah.
I can see that as a totally legitimate thing.
And defrocking is a thing, right? Is that a thing for nuns?
And we also, like, people also misunderstand what excommunication is about. Excommunication is not about... You are cast out of the church and into the darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. Excommunication is a tool of discipline. So the idea is you are excommunicated for a time so that you will come back.
Ah, gotcha.
Right? Like, that is what excommunication is about.
I
And so, I mean, on some level, we have that. I mean, there are instances I know about in the Anglican Church where a priest has held someone back from communion for a period.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Until some issue is resolved.
Gotcha.
It is a pretty rare occurrence.
Especially with Anglicans, I have to imagine.
We are Anglicans, let's be honest. But I have heard of it happening.
Okay. In the same way that we have our secret
exorcists?
Yes.
Yeah, it's true.
So we have all the cool things the Catholics have. We're just less showy about it.
So you're just saying that to bait Tom?
I guess. But no, Orange is the New Black. We would binge-watch through it. What are your thoughts?
I like Orange is the New Black quite a lot.
I like it quite a bit as well.
It kind of goes with what we had in our last podcast, where there's a lot of content in that show which could rightly be termed blue.
It's a little explicit, not going to lie.
Even the second season is just like, whoo, boy.
Well, I feel like second season, they sort of are like, people like our show because we look at these harsh prison realities and have really sympathetic characters. Also, we have a lot of nudity.
But, like, beyond nudity.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I think it is a show that does a remarkably good job at being, a show about women.
Yeah. Sort of by default.
Well, sort of by default, but at the same time, like, that's a default that you can't take for granted, because that would not have, you know, the assumption by all of these producers and executives is people don't want to see shows about women.
Very true.
Or to take them seriously on the same level.
Or that they would be only targetable
to women.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas, I mean, this is a show about women, and it's a show about women of color.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I've read some reference. I read some article in which someone was talking about how I keep wanting to call it Orphan is the New Black.
Yeah,
I can't stop doing that.
That would be a really bizarre mashup show. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm sure at some point Funny or Die will give us Orphan is the New Black, but that would be very strange.
Anyway, I have read a reference to all of this criticism of Orange is the New Black for its poor racial depictions and its stereotypical characters.
Yeah.
But I can't actually find those. I've searched and I can't find those essays or articles. I can see the point that all of that, those characters and situations and stories are mediated to the audience through the lens of an incredibly privileged white character.
Well, that's something you
touched
on.
Those stories are we only hear those stories because this incredibly privileged white person went to prison and then got a book deal out of it.
Yes.
And so people want to hear her story, and that has given credence. And so I can see on some, like, strange meta level the criticism that we are only hearing these stories mediated to us through the lens of white privilege.
Well, we would only care about visiting this situation if there was a character
like
we could sympathize
with. But at the same time, I feel like the show itself kind of baits and switches us, right? I mean, the show drew an audience. Like the show existed because there was this central character whose story we allegedly care about hearing.
Yeah.
But then it pulls a switch on you, and the show has gained its real popularity and its real emotional core by not really being about her at all.
Well, it started off being this kind of fish out of water, like, oh, here's this person you can sympathize with, like a pretty upper middle class white girl with like all the education in the world and all the sort of like privilege, who's now in this terrible situation. And, you know, it's sort of like Shawshank Redemption, where you're following, you know, you're following Dufresne through and you sympathize because he's like an educated guy. But yeah, it then very, very quickly becomes an ensemble show where she, while still getting the plurality of story, doesn't have, like, all the story. Like,
or even the majority of the story.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, she's getting more screen time of anyone, but it's not 60% her, 40% them. And that's what I really like.
And I think it's interesting that in making season two, the producers realized that that's what the audiences were responding to and gave more of the secondary characters and much less Piper.
Well, and the central conflict of the second season
isn't really about her at all. No.
And that's what I really enjoyed. I enjoy the fact, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of different storylines.
I would say the real core of season two is Pusey and Tasty.
Tasty, yeah.
That was for me. I mean, that's well, the compelling story.
The relationship Usei and Tasty and the relationship of V and Red. I think those sort of are the two main issues that we're seeing again and again. But it's a relationship of all of them, right? Because you can't talk about like their relationship with V without talking about V's relationship with Crazy Eyes. And like, I mean, the show is so remarkably tight in terms of the fact that it keeps all of its storylines really tied together. They did a lot more with the horrible assistant warden this season.
Oh, yeah.
And what I loved, and I guess it could be seen as problematic because it's giving voice to people already with power, but that you saw so much of the correctional officers and the wardens, and it wasn't just...
But I think it's an interesting corrective that situations of power and privilege are on some level contextual, and you can have power and privilege in one situation and not have the same privilege in another situation.
That's really true.
And so you see a situation where these guards have all the power,
but
they
are
wielding that power because they're trapped in there themselves, and they're trapped in that situation by their lives. And you know, it's complexities. When we talk about power and privilege and all of the stuff that's so trendy to talk about these days, these are really complicated issues. And I think one of the reasons why white men, particularly, say, lower middle class white men, are so outraged by hearing about their own privilege is they don't understand that reality that, or I shouldn't say they, that sounds, I think we as a society find it difficult to speak about how privilege is so contextualized.
Oh, yeah.
And you can have so much privilege in one context and not in another.
Well,
and so you see these characters who are white men who seem at the outset to be the people who hold all the power in this situation. And only as you get to know them, you realize how powerless they actually are as well. And all of them are just trapped in this horrible cesspool of prison.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I also loved was I felt the first season, the awful, like, young correctional officer, like, I felt like he was a little too kid-gloved, and he was sort of put in this awkward situation with his, like, baby mama.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel like this season...
You saw a real darker side to him?
Well, also, I kind of feel like the writer's like, oh, wait, this is a terrible guy. Like, this is a guy who knocked up a prisoner. Like, we sort of like, oh, no, it's this Romeo and Juliet situation, and oh, how will it work out? And like, no, wait, no, this is terrible. And just, like, completely, I don't know if they changed writers or what happened.
Yeah, that relationship definitely took a harsher turn.
Well, they're just like, oh, you know what? What if they actually didn't, like, the situation made it so they weren't really in love? Because they're not, you know, it's going to be really hard to have genuine love in a place like this.
Yeah.
And now they're both sort of stuck with this situation.
They were sort of besotted.
Yeah.
But that's different than love. Oh, yeah.
And it's just, and I love that change. I felt that was so just well thought out and a shift. I mean, I guess people could complain that it's like an unfair
but
shift.
But I don't think it was out of character.
No, I don't
either. I think you still saw how much they wanted to be in love with each other.
Well, and they...
That they're in a terrible situation.
Well, and that he held himself to this really sort of high ideal of himself and was having to kind of... be like, oh, wait, I'm really not.
And then he was constantly, by being in this situation, was constantly being compromised.
Oh, yeah. No, I love that. And the Caputo stuff this season. They, like, man.
Caputo is the, what is his actual job?
I don't really know. Like, it's sort of like main administrator who actually has to deal with everything.
Yeah.
But the handlebar-y mustache sad guy with his terrible band.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That was, I mean... That felt very, what's the TV show about that felt very Parks and Recreation.
Oh,
you
yes.
know, you know, like just like, oh, here's the awful like side jobs they have. But I really loved it. And I loved how they continued his relationship with the other correctional officer. And then like how they dealt with that, I felt was really compelling. All in all, I thought this was a remarkable second season in terms of, you know, building off what we had started off with, but really just exploring it in a bunch of new ways. I mean, there's a soap opera-y element to it. You know,
oh,
I mean,
course.
there's stuff that's like, this is kind of ridiculous that this is all happening now, at this very short span of time. But I loved it. And I love her brother so much. That was pretty amazing. His wedding hijacking a funeral so that they could use the same flowers. If you were in a pastoral position and such a occurrence took place, what would be the appropriate response, Rachel?
The appropriate response would be to explain that they would not have duly complied with canon law, and they had not been, as we say in our marriage liturgy, duly prepared for matrimony, and it would be pastorally inappropriate to go forward.
Now, they had brought their own pastor with them.
Well, then I guess that would be okay.
You just then, like, have to figure out how to charge them for the space.
Dude, it's true.
Are you trying to figure out the logistics of a hijacked funeral wedding?
I got a funeral coming up on Friday. I don't want to think about it.
They're already problematic enough.
Yes.
So we blitzed through Orange Is the New Black in about, what, like 3-4 days?
Yes.
That was pretty hardcore.
Our house is a mess. Because any non-baby time we spent watching that.
That's very true. But that's not the only TV that we have to finish up. We are so close. We are two episodes away.
So close to finishing Star Trek.
We have Deep Space Nine in our sights. We have Season 7. Season 7 has been such a bizarre roller coaster of really good and really awful.
Yeah, mostly really awful. That stupid baseball game. Was this season?
Think
about how long we've been watching this season.
Well, it's just every time we
Vic
like
Fontaine.
Every time we sort of like sat, looked at the DVDs, it was like, ooh, what if it's a Vic Fontaine episode?
It's true.
But we are in the, like, the good home stretch where they stop having like individual plots for the episodes. They're just like essentially one long story, like one long miniseries. And yes, we are down to the final wire for that. Further proving that Goldacott's one of the greatest villains in all of Star Trek history.
I'm about to fall asleep.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Hey everyone, it's Lehman, just taking a quick moment to offer something of a commercial in between our bizarre two-part episode, and I just want to let you all know that we are, of course, on iTunes and Stitcher, and if you can write us up a quick review and a rating, let us know how we're doing, that would be wonderful, it helps our numbers pop around. Also, give a visit to our website. I always put up a bit of a show notes with various whimsical links at the justgeekwallyyoked.com, and we're also on Facebook, as always, where you can go there and make comments and send us fun little tidbits, which we always enjoy. It gives us ideas for shows, and we like to see a little bit more, activity, involvement, places where we can interact with y'all in better ways. And if you're someone who's never commented before, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to know where our listeners come from. Make sure it's not just our friends Tom and Rachel, although we appreciate them. And also, do check out the Crossover Nexus. We're going to be doing a lot more work with them, and we really appreciate all that they do, and really... helping us build something of a community. So that'll be it for me. I'll let you get back to the second part of our potpourri episode. Geek out. And we are back.
How long is it? Like 2 days later?
I don't know. But more importantly, we finished Deep Space Nine. So now you get to hear the wonder in our voice as we live in a new world where Rachel has now seen the finale of Deep Space Nine.
It was a good finale.
It's an all right finale.
It's a good finale. Like, for a show that ran for 7 years.
Yeah.
The seventh season was not good. It took us, I think Amanda was not born yet when we started watching it. But
well, season 7 is just so uneven. Like, you're dealing with them trying to catch Ezri Dax up to speed, and I feel like that
so much of the season got given over to her. I just got so, like, it was just like every other episode was about Ezri.
Well, and just...
And after the stakes of season 6, which were so high, suddenly the stakes seemed so low, and it's like they forgot that they were in a war.
Well, you have some amazing stuff going on, but yeah, then you just, there's a lot of treading water and a lot of like kind of bouncing around from place to place and figuring out, you know, how to get their ducks lined up so that by the time they kind of get to the final push of season 7, those last few episodes are amazing. Again, when they stop sort of having individual arcs.
Well, I was saying, it reminds me of Babylon 5.
Oh, yeah.
Where the first half of the season 5 of Babylon 5 is... I'm going to gouge my eyes out if I have to watch Byron do anything else with his terrible 90s hair.
Just introducing some random new actor?
Well, I think it's a similar thing to Ezri Dax, right? Yeah. It's a random new actor. It's someone the writers are really invested in making you sympathize with when, you know, it's maybe... Well, okay, I think Ezri is probably less egregious than Byron because he was just so incredibly terrible.
Yeah.
But... and Ezri is just, it's not her fault that she's not Jadzia. But you're like, I've already given so much of myself to all of these other people. I don't have anything left.
Well, and
you know what?
The fact is, we had a good run with Dax. I love Jadzia Dax.
Yeah.
But you're never going to have that character back.
So why have another Trill? Why have someone who's just.
And I mean, yeah, and just, I felt, you know, I guess, I feel like you could have done more with Cassidy Yates if you're trying to, like, make sure there's, like, a still a stronger female presence on the
show.
Exactly. Like, that's something we never saw. We never saw, like, a Cassidy Yates, like,
centric
sort
episode.
Of, like,
yeah,
her
absolutely.
Going off, doing some stuff, you know, getting into adventures with folks.
No, it's
I mean,
really
it just,
true.
It seemed like they needed to resolve Worf's love interest issues.
Yeah.
And then give Julian a girlfriend.
Pretty much.
And other than
Bilbo
that,
agrees.
Bilbo agrees. And other than that, yeah, I was thinking about this, and I realized that if you had taken all the time they had spent on Ezri Dax and Vic Fontaine,
yeah, there's a lot of Vic Fontaine.
And if you instead use that time to actually and interestingly tie in the Maquis to the whole Dominion War,
because they kind of just disappeared.
Well, yeah, the Maquis disappear with the whole that the villainous, the treacherous Federation guy, Tom, what's his name? You know, who Sisko weirdly obsesses over. They dealt with that for so long, and now you are literally at war with the Cardassians, which was essentially the whole point of the Maquis, and they disappear. They're gone, and not even dealt with. Apparently, from what I've heard from Facebook, one way they tie this everything back in is that Roel Laren, who was an ensign on Next Generation, who they had, like, essentially do a Donnie Brasco and go undercover with the Maquis and then sympathize and, like, defect the Maquis.
Oh,
they shit. Have her come back and take over Deep Space Nine after Sisko is gone in the novels.
Oh.
So I guess there's, like, a weird, like, Maquis redemption in the wake of the Dominion Wars, which... So, I mean, because that's the thing, right? You have a whole group of people who have been at war with the Cardassians, and now the Cardassians are the enemy of the Federation. So where does that leave these folks? You know, are they still criminals because they were violating the treaties of, or are they now folks that are being like, you guys? It's like the Bajorans. You guys know how to fight the Cardassians. Let's work together. But that's not dealt with at all, which is weird because they were obsessed with the Maquis to the point that I was getting like bored with the Maquis.
So, other than that, it was a very good finale.
It is. I thought
it was bittersweet. I thought the way they dealt with Sisko's character had a really fascinating fairy tale quality to it that you don't. And maybe it's the fact that I like things that have more of a fairy tale
than a science fiction quality.
I mean, it's why I like Babylon 5.
Yeah.
In some ways, more when it's in kind of epic.
Mode
than when it's in just pure
sci-fi alien
mode. Sometimes, although the
you like the politics stuff.
Except
so much.
That, yeah, I don't really know why I'm saying that because Jakar and Londo and Centauri Prime, that's all so. Yeah. That's really meaty.
But that's sort of interpersonal, I guess. And as well.
But I liked how they dealt with Sisko. I liked his end, and I liked that it wasn't that it was sort of a bittersweet.
Yeah.
And I thought that the arc of Gul Dukat was so powerful. Even the I still hate the actress who plays Kai Winn, but I like her character.
Yeah,
I really like her character. I really liked how they had her, you know, betray the prophets and fall to the Paw Wraiths.
Oh yeah,
only to have that be her downfall. And I thought that was very powerful. And you know, Odo and Kira's relationship never felt like they actually had any chemistry, but even that, you know, having Odo rejoin the Link felt like the right thing that had been the gun on the table
for a couple of seasons
ever since they found
like,
them.
Yeah. Why would he not go back? Yeah.
So I don't know. We've talked about this before on this podcast that it's so rare to find an ending to a long-running series that is satisfying.
Yeah.
That actually you're like, I feel narratively fulfilled and satisfied by that. I feel like I have closure and I'm happy with it. I mean, I'm not saying it was brilliant. I'm just saying that I guess we actually sort of started in season 3, but I've invested 5 seasons worth of watching in this show.
Yeah.
And I'm good.
I'm good. I liked it. I was, you know, I need to go back and watch All Good Things, because that still sits in my memory as the greatest Star Trek finale. That's the Next Generation one.
Even though they took it away from Netflix.
They did take it away from Netflix. But I like this a lot. I mean, it definitely has a lot of, like, now we're going to do some glossy, like, oversaturated slow-mo.
Oh, of course! It was incredibly emotionally manipulative. But
going through the best of, you got to see your two, Bashir and O'Brien.
I loved the fact that the most heart-rending interpersonal montage was not with any of the romantic couples, but was with Julian and Miles.
Well, they had
that relationship is the heart of Deep Space Nine.
And they show them singing Jerusalem, which is probably one of your favorite moments.
It is. We should link to that.
We should.
In the show notes. And I also wonder if it says something about the way TV narrative works today, or at least did. I wonder if we're moving away from that again, perhaps. But the way it did, I don't know, 5-8 years ago, I'm thinking about like the heyday of Lost and BSG and those types of shows,
okay,
which were so like mystery based.
Oh, okay.
And so like constantly holding this carrot of illumination and resolution out in front of you and then never quite delivered.
Well, we don't watch, like, I don't know, Homeland.
Oh, I don't know. All I'm saying is that I wonder if why something like Deep Space Nine can have a more satisfying ending, because it just, you're sort of just seeing a story unfold each episode, and they managed to have a pretty consistent overarching storyline. But it was mostly just the suspense was built into what's going to happen next, not what is the answer to this mystery.
No,
going
precisely.
To be.
Like, yeah, and you're, so you're not trying to figure out what's the deal with the
so that
with
when
the orbs,
mystery so when
the founders,
yeah so
like,
when the mystery is
with.
Finally solved, you're like, meh, or like the build up to the end is so intense that it can never live up to the hype.
Yeah.
Whereas this just, you know, you're watching it go along for 7 years, and you see characters grow and change, and you see things happen, and you see things with the Dominion escalate, and you see the introduction of Wei Yun, even though Bilbo ate that disc of our DVDs.
Ah!
And then when it ends, you're like, okay, I have closure.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Deep Space Nine got a lot of flack for being the bus station in space. I mean, people really were like, what is the point of watching a show where they don't go anywhere?
Mm.
And I think we saw that the boatness of that is that you do have this great, like, sort of tight bottle where people are sort of stuck and have to
thrown
deal
together,
with, and they have to deal with the ramifications of their actions.
You know,
one of the big things they talked about was, you know, if they did something on Bajor, there would you still had to deal with the politics of Bajor. You know, like when they get there, when their main guy becomes prime minister, then suddenly there's a huge conflict with, like, you know, the religious caste, or when you know, Kira starts dating one of the main religious people. Well, now there's that issue as well.
Yeah.
As they put it on Next Generation, you know, you saw them go to a planet, establish their, like, you know, Ministry of Security,
and then bye-bye,
and then leave, and you don't see that, like, descend into anarchy or, like, you know, a dictatorship arise out of that. You know, when that's...
So, I mean, what's the cynicism of Deep Space Nine, then?
Well, the cynicism of Deep Space Nine is that nothing happens because they're just on a bus station in space, and it's the same people over and over and over and over and over again. And they have to find excuses.
Or that we inevitably fall into these patterns of politics and...
I feel like
ramifications for actions.
Well,
and
I personally feel that people who talk about it are folks who haven't sat down and watched it. Right? It's the same people who criticize Babylon 5 for the same reason. You know, like, it's just a space station.
That's because Deep Space Nine was a ripoff of Babylon 5.
Well, yes. I remember someone being really outraged when IO9 posted this big article about why Deep Space Nine, like, introduced all these great things and was terribly innovative. And my friends were like, Babylon 5 did that first. Babylon 5 did that first. Babylon 5 did that first. But I do feel like they're very distinct shows. I mean, they both have, like, a sort of weird giant war with, like, kind of a strange, like, alien, all-powerful entity.
Oh, I think
it's
fair to say they are different shows.
Because Babylon 5, and I guess they also have, like, a quasi-religious sort of aspect as well.
Well, and if you think about how Babylon 5 was supposed to go down, Sinclair Sinclair and Sisko both have this idea of... I guess, spoiler alert, this idea of Sinclair becoming Valen has very much that quality of Sisko being the emissary. Yeah. And they changed that because they ended up with Sheridan being much more the, like, Warhawk kind of guy who grows into a more political role, but not necessarily a more religious role.
And that worked. I mean, and
so is this becoming our Babylon
5
versus
Deep Space Nine?
This is what happens when we have no plans.
But I feel like... I don't know. I feel like there is something very different. I think it boils down to the characters, largely.
I do. I think they evolved into very different things, but I'm saying if you're going to talk about how Ron Moore was in the production meetings for Babylon 5 and then went off and created Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
Let's just point out, like, lay out that what
Then we see what he takes from that to Battlestar Galactica.
The idea of the clones, and then the big strategic, one of their big strategic goals is to destroy the factory where the
clones are made. So that they can't. Weyoun can't keep regenerating. That was pretty amazing. We saw something. There was something else that they burled. Anyway, there's a lot of things that he burled from that. I mean, the sort of the weird quasi-religious nature
of course,
the founders versus the, you know, their whole empire. But the
what Babylon 5 did not have a shapeshifter.
Babylon 5 did not have a shapeshifter. They spent all their, like, bad 90s CGI on their ships.
Oh, man, that was not a good call. Yeah, CGI versus the Star Trek models.
Well, I mean, if you think about those battle scenes at the end of season 7, or during season 6 and season 7, they are fantastic.
The battle scenes in Babylon 5 are not particularly good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think if you have to think about Babylon 5 is a novel, right? It was written by someone who is trained in the theater, is all about language and words, and it is very elegantly written, if occasionally overwritten.
Yes.
The special effects were not, I think, J. Michael Straczynski's passion.
Well, and with Deep Space Nine and Next Generation, you know, they were using the models, they were using the, like, sort of matte painting of a planet with, like, maybe, like, a few sort of figures moving to get, you know, like, when you're going in, you know, they always have that sort of obviously illustrated cityscape. But it really gave a whole, you know, just, it gave you an instantly new, oh, I'm on Ferenginar. Yeah. Oh, I'm on Cardassia.
Yeah.
And I remember someone was talking about how the main difference between aliens on Star Trek and Babylon 5 was when Star Trek, all the, like, head ridges and frills were on the front of the alien, and on Babylon 5, they're all on the back.
Wasn't that your brother?
That's probably my brother. But with Deep Space Nine, it's big break from Star Trek. Well, it's two big breaks. Was one really casting the Federation in a darker light. With its, like, Sector 31 or Section 31, the spy network, kind of the weird black ops network, not only having that there, but having them be villainous, but also having them really be an integral part of Federation and be like, we've been here and we've been doing this. And I want to say that the new movies are actually acknowledging that. I want to say that was, like, the weird, like, at the beginning when the guy does the terrorist act, the Federation guy does, I think that's, like, a Section 31 thing that they were representing. I could be wrong, but I feel like it is. I feel like it would be very J.J. Abrams to like, bring that in. But having a war, that was something that that was completely sort of against the spirit of what Roddenberry wanted to do. And yet that's what they did. You know, and it wasn't just fighting at the sort of kind of, you know, hive mind robot consciousness of the Borg. It was an all-out war with other sentient races, and the whole war was problematized. I mean, I remember when our friend Andrew got, like, really excited because the Jem'Hadar were this obvious race of, like, orc aliens, and you could kill them indiscriminately, and they were just evil.
And then they got humanized.
And then he realized, oh no, they're the slave race that's been, like, addicted to a chemical, and, like, they'll die without it. Oh no, conflicted emotions. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, Andrew also didn't like Angel because Angel introduced morally ambiguous
vampires.
Demons into the Buffy universe.
That is true. But that's. I mean, you know, for me, Deep Space Nine is what I grew up on. Like, it was the Star Trek I watched a whole heck of a lot of, and I watched to its conclusion. I mean, I remember, I can tell you the episode I watched when I came back to America in 1993 and was sitting in my grandmother's living room, and it was the weird, dumb episode where Q shows up on Deep Space Nine and is, like, messing with the crew there. I want to say maybe Vash, like, Picard's.
Did we watch that?
That may be a season 2 episode. Okay. I don't know. But it's at one point he takes Sisko into a ring and they're boxing.
Ugh. The only episode I actually remember watching on TV, I remember spending sad Saturday nights because I never did anything in high school, watching, like, Star Trek and Hercules and Xena.
Yay!
Strange shows on TV. But the only episode that I actually distinctly remember seeing when it was on is the one where Odo's stuck in the rock and
Where he's slowly turning into rock.
Kira are together and Kira's stuck in the rock.
Yes.
But it ends up being a shapeshifter.
Yes.
And they're testing him.
Yes.
No. It's one of the only distinct episodes I remember.
Yeah.
Here's my what is your favorite thing in Deep Space Nine?
It's
aside from Garak.
I love Garak so much. It really is how the characters interact and their relationships. I mean, I love how Odo and Quark's sort of antagonistic relationship bloomed. Mm-hmm. I love Quark's relationship with his brother and he becomes sort of this family man. I love Miles's relationship with Bashir. I love Bashir's relationship with Garak. You know, like everyone is just so interconnected and they really played things so well. And those relationships become so integral to the show. I mean, again, at the end, they're going through and it's not just showing kind of individual people's memories of stuff, but it's like groups of them together and how mm-hmm. they interacted. I think Worf was the only one that they kind of showed sort of being slightly on his own in those flashbacks. But even then, you know, they showed him with Dax and they showed him sort of arguing with Quark. You know, like that to me was the heart of Deep Space Nine, was seeing these characters. And I feel like that's the strongest thing the show has going for it. Like, you know, Next Generation has kind of iconic characters.
Yeah, but they don't really change much. And their dynamics don't change fundamentally over the course of the show.
No, they don't. And that's, I mean, to quote one of my favorite podcasts, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff, you know, there's the difference between the iconic characters that don't change and dynamic characters who do, and the tension when you sort of try to make iconic characters dynamic, you know, when you try to, like, make Batman have a slightly different relationship. You know, it just doesn't work. But I do feel like Deep Space Nine did a wonderful job of giving you characters, having them change. You know, you see Miles go from being just the gruff engineer to, like, being this other guy who's so dependent on his relationship and his friendships. You see Miles go from, Julian going from being the, like, goofy flirt to the kind of tragic, you know, mutant.
Yeah.
And I mean, Sisko wildly changes. Sisko starts off as this widower with a chip on his shoulder.
Well, he doesn't even want to be there.
Yeah, who's completely reluctant and completely, like, just not interested. You know, is just going to, like, you know, play out his time and then leave. And not even that, but just was kind of really spiky with everyone.
Well, he was
wanting
to resign from Starfleet and just go raise his son. And, I mean, I think that's to see him at the end having something that he's willing to sacrifice his life for.
Yes.
I mean, that is amazing. And I mean, I don't know if we've talked about this on this podcast or whether I think the guys over at Strangers and Aliens mentioned it when they did their talk about, like, great pilots.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, the pilot of Deep Space Nine is fantastic.
It is good up until the wormhole aliens start asking what is.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, from the point that the scene between Sisko and Picard is phenomenally brilliant.
Yes.
Because you have Picard, the great hero of Star Trek, in this room with a man whose wife's death he caused.
Yes.
Even inadvertently, unintentionally.
As Locutus.
Yeah. As Locutus, he caused this man's wife to die.
Yeah.
And suddenly you have someone looking at Picard with animosity and suspicion
antagonism.
And disdain. And that just immediately tells you that, okay, we're in a different Star Trek. And it's a great way to introduce, like, to kind of create that link and, you know, have Picard in there and have that connection with the previous Star Trek universe, but also saying that this is something different.
It is something different. And the entire show really, you know, it was a show, you know, where the Federation played a role, but it was not a show determined by the Federation. One of my friends, Michael Davis, likes to talk about how Quark is this great character who is constantly pointing out the strangeness and the inconsistencies in the Federation.
Yeah.
You know, and he's there to kind of be like, you know, this is bizarre behavior. You know, like, humanity has, like, you know, has this, you know, he has this whole line about, you know, you take away their comforts, you take away their replicators, and they're more savage than any Klingon.
Mm.
You know, like, it's this very interesting commentary on itself in a very meta, sort of Ron Moore-ish way. But Next Generation wasn't that show. Next Generation was trying to take the classic Trek, put it, you know, bring it to the 80s, and was about adventures and you know,
hope and optimism and all of that stuff.
And Deep Space Nine was a lot more introspective, you know, and it was darker as a result.
It was the 90s. It was all about grunge.
It was nice.
Although it was also like the 90s were also pretty happy, you know, like, so I don't really know.
This is sort of a pre-September 11th, yeah. You know, like this was prefiguring a lot of like how would we respond in these situations, right?
Although one of the things was fascinating was that episode, I don't remember what season it is, but yeah. When they go back to the late 20th century or early 21st century.
Oh yes, the Bell Riots.
And it's basically Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, well, and it's also,
and,
yeah.
And we watched that like during the Occupy protests.
That was,
and it was pretty, weirdly prescient.
It was very fascinating. Yeah, the way they were talking about like, yeah,
wealth disparities and the rising up of those who are feeling disenfranchised in these like populist demonstrations and
how, you know, yeah, cities were kind of starting to be even kind of walled off and separated yeah. off. No, that was fascinating. There were some really awful fashion choices as far as Dax is concerned.
Yes, well.
That episode was amazing. The episode where Sisko goes back to the 50s, either in his mind or something, and they do...
That was really powerful.
And they do an entire commentary on, like, science fiction as a whole, and science fiction's incredibly problematic relationship with race.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been getting into all these fights with Lovecraft fans about, like, Lovecraft's racial legacy and things like that. But science fiction has it as well, you know? Like, it was a fandom that largely ignored black and female contributions and wrote itself as, you know, the fandom of white maledom. And, you know, to the point that it's now seems like that, and you have the whole fake geek girl...
Yeah.
...issues that pop up from time to time. So DC Stein was willing to challenge not only
its
universe, but like its genre.
Well, and if we're naming really strong episodes, the one where Sisko gets the Romulans in league with the Federation.
In the Pale Moonlight.
I mean, that's probably one of the darkest episodes of Deep Space Nine. It's one of those where do the ends justify the means?
Precisely.
Because he basically commits this huge act of deceit using Garak.
Yeah.
As
deceit and murder.
Yeah. Oh, right. And murder. Yes. It's the classic escalation.
Yes.
You know, it starts off with a simple idea that then just grows.
Oh, yeah.
And expands. And where is the line? And eventually they get the Romulans on board against the Dominion, but
yeah.
What cost?
And it's interesting, right? Because it's one of those situations where, like, you know, Dominion might very well have been planning something like this, but they still had to fake it. They still, yeah. They had to make the choice. The amoral choice.
To create a scenario that they could present in which the Dominion was planning to betray the Romulans.
They faked they made a holographic recording that they said was a recording of an actual meeting that took place where Weyoun and the Cardassians were planning a strike against Romulus. And they forged this and presented this to the Romulan Empire and said, see, look, this is what's going to happen. And the Romulans came on board. And it's wonderful because you've got Garak there.
Yeah.
Who's this great, poisonous, beautiful character who at the end is the one kind of secondary cast member who is not given a happy ending. Like his final moments on the show.
Oh, between him and Julian?
Where he's just like, you know... Something will emerge, my people will survive, but it won't be the Cardassia I knew.
Yeah.
You know, like, my planet is gone. My culture is gone.
Even for someone who was effectively exiled from Cardassia to have still his home.
Well, and Andrew J. Robinson, that actor, actually, I need to go back and finish it, but I started reading, he wrote an autobiography of Garak called A Stitch in Time, which is amazing. But it's sort of twofold. It sort of is... It's Garak talking about his time after the war, like, you know, essentially him just in the ash piles of Cardassia trying to pick up the pieces. And then it's also him talking about where he came from. And apparently Andrew J. Robinson based this on as an acting exercise, he was writing journal entries.
Oh, okay.
And for his character and coming up with sort of a back history and things like that. And he... You know, brought it forward and said, you know, I've been writing this and working on this. I'd like to turn this into a novel. And it's now an official canon novel. And it's one of the just most fascinating books to read. Like, it's a great, it's, you know, where I'm at right now, he's sort of in his weird Cardassian military school. So it's like evil Harry Potter as he's being picked on and slowly, like, determining, like, you know, where he's going to fit in society. Garak is one of the great characters, right? Because he's sort of, you know... He would be the comic foil. He would be the, like, the
except kind of, that he's also a really dark character.
He's so dark, you know. He's the one who wanted to like commit acts of genocide on multiple occasions against the founders. No, he has so much just darkness roiling through him. He's the one who is sort of corrupts Sisko's soul. And if you're hearing strange noises, that would be Bilbo playing with his awful chew toy, so we apologize for any gross, moist sounds.
So we were talking about the relationships between characters, and I just have to say, I think my favorite on the show, aside from Miles and Julian, their love is true.
Yes.
But Kira and Dukat.
Yeah.
I mean, Dukat, he might be my favorite character on the whole show. I think he is certainly a fascinating villain.
Yeah.
And the... the ebb and flow of his villain to unlikely
ally
to villain to like uber to like major arc, like truly black evil villain. Yeah. And what fascinates me all the way through is that it's the epitome of the villain who is convinced of his own righteousness.
Oh yeah.
At least until the end.
Oh yeah.
I feel like maybe at the end he's really just truly trying to grasp power, but...
Well, yeah, he gets on a bit of a nihilistic bent. I mean, by that point he's like weirdly possessed by creatures, but like even his cult episode.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just like, oh, he's just behaving like every cult leader.
But like, and the stuff with the Bajorans earlier on. I mean, his villainy came out of the fact that he resented the Bajorans for not loving him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's fascinating.
Oh, no. He is amazing. And yeah, precisely. His relationship with Kira. It's like
he's punishing them for not...
Recognizing his brilliance and the gift. Like, things could have been so much worse. Like, I would have had to... You know, I could have executed so many more people. You know, don't you understand that?
Yeah.
No, it's this amazing narcissism, this amazing arrogance,
and his relationship with his daughter, like finding out that he had a half Bajoran daughter.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. No, that was and like essentially wanting to kill her, to save the face and also because out of a weird sense of care for her because she would have no place.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's again, but it's, you know, he's the one who's going to make this decision. And you know, it's up to him. You know, yeah, precisely. It's that he sees himself as this great hero, this great man. I love the Cardassians. You know, I love the fact that Next Generation sort of invented a whole host of aliens, and Deep Space Nine took them and put them in a much better place.
The Ferengis.
If you look at the first like shush scenes of the Ferengi.
They were supposed to be like villains, weren't they?
Well, they were supposed to be this like sinister new race, and like, oh, what's going on? The Ferengi are like messing up this alliance, and blah blah blah. And they were all like strange barbarians with blue whips. And their misogyny was there from the beginning, and that was kept. But Deep Space Nine, after a while, I can't remember which one started translating them more into like awful space traders with potentially problematic racial characteristics. But by Deep Space Nine, you know, they were transformed into a silly culture, but like a culture that began to get more and more rigidly defined. And probably the best moment for them was when Quark goes back in time and they redo Little Green Men, which was actually a Next Gen episode, a Classic Trek episode where the crew of the Enterprise gets sent back and become the Roswell aliens. This is a reference to that. This is them redoing that. So the Quark and his brother go back in time and become the Roswell aliens. But Quark talks about what he wants to do is essentially take all of his knowledge, go find Ferenginar, and make the Ferengi the most powerful technological race, you know, so that, you know, they're not the jokes of the universe. They're not the, like, the sort of put upon goofy, just like gag, which is, and so again, bizarre commentary on the show there. After a while, they sort of were like, let's show social progress. Let's sort of have like our weird commentary on 90s commentary on capitalism.
Yeah.
But it also gave, you know, it gave Wallace Shawn a job, and I always approve of that. It also gave us the amazing Magnificent Seven Ferengi, where they like raid a station.
Oh, that's true.
Which I want to say Iggy Pop was the villain of that episode, which
he
is very
was,
strange.
Yes.
Anyway,
I guess of all the characters, Quark is the one who kind of most remained where he was at the beginning, but is a changed person.
Yeah,
but he's still in the same situation.
Sort of same situation, same choice. No, I mean, he definitely went through some very interesting journeys, and they could tell some very interesting stories with him. in ways that, you know, again, they just didn't have a character like that. And I feel like they sort of tried to do it again with Neelix.
Oh, let's... Why taint? Why taint? Go away.
Yeah. And I guess Dr. Phlox on Enterprise. Anyway, but yeah, they sort of tried to capture that magic, and they couldn't because Armin Shimmerman just had that wonderful, like,
well, he's just awesome.
Snarky, pedantic, you know, slightly fey, but really just charming personality.
And then he gets eaten by a giant snake.
Well, not in this series, luckily. Instead, he and Odo almost freeze to death on a mountain, which I really remember. I love that episode when I remember watching that. And Odo. Odo was such a unique character. This, like, completely alone person. He was essentially the Data of the show. You know?
Oh, yeah.
This, like, singular person.
Way in which it fits into the Star Trek formula.
But, you know, the fact that he was tied... You know, the fact that he was this sort of weird character and his origin was so important to the show. You know, like, you know, the Founders became this wonderful menace.
Yeah.
And this creepy, you know, shape-shifting menace. And they were able to do all sorts of, like... Like paranoid Cold War, like we need to test your blood, you know, to make sure you're.
Oh
not
yeah,
a
that's another thing they got from they took to BSG. Oh, about,
yes, the test. So that was so yeah, I just all in all, it was a wonderful show, and I'm very happy that I got to take you on this crazy journey through it.
I really liked it,
even if occasionally there was some awful hair and Vic Fontaine and. That one awful episode where they go to Ryza and, like, religious fundamentalists try to take over.
No, I just don't know. I just don't know what I'm gonna do because I need space. Like, I've now watched Babylon 5. Yep. I've now watched
Farscape.
We all know that I've watched Farscape. I could just do another rewatch of Farscape.
There's Andromeda, but like Kevin Sorbo,
think I can watch anything with Kevin Sorbo. Yeah.
But I mean, I saw bits of it for a time. I mean, I think it's very Canadian. But it was, you know, it was pretty space opery. I feel like I heard, there's going to be, no, there's not.
The Captain Worf thing keeps getting thrown, like, I keep seeing that popping up every so often. And when Michael Dorn was here.
Yes.
As part of the Next Gen panel at last year's Comic-Con.
All right, you went to that.
He did make some
oblique
references to it.
Well, then there was the brief rumor that there's going to be a Netflix Trek show, but that went
went the way of the Firefly Netflix
precisely.
Show.
So yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other like shows that there's like Lex, but that was like I feel like that was super dumb.
I don't know what it is, but I just love space opera.
Well, space opera is pretty amazing, and you get fun rubber suits.
It's true.
You got nothing. What's that new Farscape show that was like...
No, there's a new Farscape. There's rumors... Actually, I think it's more... Like, it's been reported on many news sources.
Yeah.
That a new Farscape movie is officially in the works. It's being written by one of the main Farscape writers.
Okay.
It is going to be about John and Aaron's son.
Oh, okay.
And I assume that Ben Browder and Claudia Black would be part of it if, you know, they can. But I mean, it's currently in the writing phase, so it could be 10 years before we ever get that.
No, sorry. What I actually meant was that show by the Farscape creators that was like,
Defiant?
Yeah, something like that.
I've heard mixed things and I don't know that I have any access to it, so.
Yeah. I think it's one of those random sci-fi shows. Well, you got your Orphan Black.
Yeah, it's not space opera.
I'm just saying you got TV shows.
There's something. I mean,
Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
I really like, as I said, I really like Orphan Black, but it's a little too dark for me. I like things that have a bit of darkness in them, but because that's where the drama comes from. But like,
we just need our Vorkosigan animated series.
I like characters that I can like.
Oh,
you know,
well,
and really,
you've got, there's
Felix.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's fair.
I think space opera breeds into it some sense of grandeur.
That's very
and a
true.
Heightened world.
Yeah.
And I think that's what interests me. That, you know, as good as any drama like an Orphan Black might be,
yeah.
It's still a drama in our world that involves police detectives and conspiracies and technology and
yeah.
Whereas whatever, I guess the common theme of space opera, whether it's a Star Trek, whether it's Battlestar Galactica or Farscape or Babylon 5, as different as these shows are,
yeah,
they definitely all have that. They exist in a heightened world.
I think that's true. No, I think that's very fair.
Star Wars.
And Star Wars.
You know, if we're going to talk about space opera.
Yes. There you go. You can go watch the Clone Wars animated show.
I guess I could.
Darth Maul comes back with his crazy spider legs or something.
Yay. So that's our impromptu podcast about Deep Space Nine.
And also Orphan is the New Black. Orange is the New Black.
Orphan is the New Black.
I'm sure that's out there somewhere. There has to be. Well, I'm sure we'll find new TV. We have our Game of Thrones season 3
to work on. We're like 2 seasons behind in Game. We're 5 outrages behind the rest of the internet.
It's so very true. We can binge watch that. That's not going to have problematic psychological reactions.
Well, fortunately, we really only are able to watch like 2 episodes a night
baby.
Unless something like Orange is, now I can't even say it anymore. Orange is the New Black comes out.
And we just let
our house fall into chaos and disrepair.
Oh, there's something fun about that. And that's very Game of Thrones. So.
There you go.
All right. I think that'll do for our potpourri episode.
I think we pulled something out. I mean, maybe we should talk something more about the religious themes of Deep Space Nine.
I don't know. I mean, the reason I sort of skipped the first 2 seasons was because I find the whole Bajoran, like, Kai sort of stuff, I found that a little trying. I mean, I don't know, maybe you will appreciate it better. Maybe you can go back and buy those box sets and you know, sort of weirdly do like a, you know,
I guess what I liked about the later season is the religion is there, but it's not, like, it's woven into the show, but I don't feel like it's oppressive.
Yeah. And I feel like, and again, this may just be my memory from when I, you know, was in high school and just wasn't interested, but I certainly felt like, there's only so many Kais I can pay attention to.
I will certainly say that we know my love of Farscape.
Yep.
My love of Farscape is true.
Can't be denied.
It cannot be denied. I am the first person to admit that Farscape cannot do religion to save its life.
Did they ever try?
Yes! Zahn was a priestess!
Oh, okay. But I mean, like...
No, but like, there was this... Like, what her religion actually was...
I just assumed that was so she could get, like, healing powers. Like, I assume that's like, you know, why you get someone to be a cleric.
But she had, like, levels, and she would talk about, like, needing to practice the craft of her priesthood, and like, she had, like, vestments and things. And it was just... what is the actual content of your religion? I have no idea. I don't know. If you were a contestant on the Jim Henson's Creature Shop Challenge, I would criticize you for your thought out backstory.
Oh, their backstories. That was a fun part of that show. Anyway, we're going to go way off the deep end. Yes, there are religions in space.
Maybe
get funky.
That could be a whole nother podcast.
Religions in space? All right. Well, now we know what to do in case we wind up in another potpourri situation.
They're like, we got to do a podcast. Who knows? We could just... Give our loyal audience our lovely and charming selves.
Hey, you know what? That's what they come here for. That and Debs and Errol.
And Bilbo making terrible noises.
We're very sorry. We're going to take you out. I just am going to play gaming with you because I like that song a lot. So if you're sick of hearing it, make your own podcast. and from the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order, geek out, y'all.
When I see you across the room
and I catch your eye,
you give me a cryptic wink,
you turn away so shy.
Ignite that passion,
blame it on you.
And so I search most earnestly
for a boy.
To spend the night gaming with you, we'll read our cards by candlelight. Gaming with you,
your turn takes some time again,
and the candles burn down low.
You seem to have won again.
what I call romance.
Lady Luck smiles down on you.
Sweet is that a jealous glance.
Moving pieces side by side, gaming with you.
You can beat me, you just have to try. Won't you play again?
Gaming with you.
If you want, I can let you win.
Gaming.